Hello and happy new year, everyone. Very excited to be back and kicking off 2020 with all of you. We are actually starting the new year of the network with a very special guest that will bring a great outside perspective to all of us and get us ready for what will be an epic 2020.
Just thinking in terms of tomorrow and change that comes, neither one asks our permission. Tomorrow shows up, as does change. And because it does, we have the opportunity to think in terms of how do we manage this? How do we handle this? How do we welcome this? How do we take full advantage of what tomorrow may bring?
Well, welcome everyone. Excited to have you back here at the network, our podcast geared around the CAPS network and experiential learning and profession-based learning, and working to bring our voices together and form our community in a different way. I'm your host, Corey Moan, the executive director here at the Blue Valley Center for Advanced Professional Studies and the CAPS network. And I am so delighted today and blessed, actually yesterday and today, to have been able to spend time with someone that we very lovingly refer to as the CAPS ambassador, and that is Mr. Clifton Talbert. Clifton is a highly well-known person who has been published many times over, so an acclaimed author, an entrepreneur at heart, someone who has been involved in lots of different elements of business, serves on various foundations at the post-secondary level and with corporations. I know the banking industry is an important one for Clifton, and happens to have quite a large heart around what we do in education as well. And Clifton, it's such a pleasure to have you here and to have you on the podcast today.
Well, Corey, thank you. It's always a pleasure for me to come to Kansas City. CAPS is a bright spot in my life, and the students that you serve and the parents that's tickled pink to be having their kids here. It's just a great place to reinvigorate your thinking about the possibilities and about the future and what the future has for all of us.
Wonderful. Well, you have quite a story, and I know we could spend hours and hours just listening to you and your story of where you come from and the people that influenced you. I don't know how to ask you to provide that story to us in a way that wouldn't be a long conversation that we would all enjoy, but maybe giving us some flavor for who you are, where you come from, because I think at the end of the day, hearing your story really feeds into this idea of how important community really is if we're going to make a difference in the lives of young people.
Well, you've hit the nail on the head when you said how important community is and what it means for young people. I'm a beneficiary of community, and this really came alive to me several years ago when I had the opportunity to lecture at the United Nations. And of course, I was overwhelmed with the request. And when I got to New York City and finally ended up in the assembly hall, I was asking, where am I going to sit? What am I going to do? You know, I'm there and this place is awesome and it's kind of scary and intimidating all at the same time. And I was shown my seat with my name in lights. And I really cried, Corey, because I remembered my life growing up in the Mississippi Delta. And it was a time when all I could see were the cotton fields of the Delta. And I thought that would be the only world I would ever know. And here I was years later, standing in the Assembly Hall of the United Nations. But my life was made possible. My dreams became reality because of the unselfishness of others. And so when I have the chance to talk to educators or corporate people, whomever, I always suggest to them, never underestimate the value of your presence on the life of another person.
Well, you have powerful words, and I think we can all appreciate, though probably none of us or very few of us have ever been in a situation like that at the United Nations, but the idea of realizing that what got you where you are was more than just your own individual pursuits.
Yeah, you know, and you said it so well, because oftentimes when one person accomplishes, it's easy to think this is what I have done. I'm the one who studied. I opened the books. I took the test. I did all of this. But what about before you had a chance to do all of that? And that is what I often think of. I think of my great aunt who raised me. She was determined that I'd get an education. Even though field work was knocking at the door, she wouldn't let me open the door. She kept me going to school all 4 years to high school, had to travel 100 miles round trip every day, never missed a day, graduated valedictorian of my class because her goal became my goal. And when it became my goal, together we worked as a team to make sure that it happened.
Wow. Wow. So there are so many lessons in here for us and corollaries to the work that we are doing and the work that we need to be doing. And one of the things we've talked a lot about today with various groups that we've been able to work with, our instructors here today, we had a chance to talk with some of the CAPS Network directors that are in the area and some other stakeholders in our school district. There was a theme around the future and imagining the future and how important it is to not only maintain our level of kind of inquisitiveness, but to continue to flex the muscles so that we get better and better at that.
Yeah.
So what would you say, to our audience about the importance of inquisitiveness, curiosity, and how that plays into the future that we want to be able to open up for our students?
You know, just thinking in terms of tomorrow and change that comes, neither one asks our permission. Tomorrow shows up, as does change. Hmm. And because it does, we have the opportunity to think in terms of how do we manage this? How do we handle this? How do we welcome this? How do we take full advantage of what tomorrow may bring? And I've learned over the years that inquisitiveness is an incredible gift that every human being has. But oftentimes, it can get cut off at a very early age, or could be in a corporate setting or a professional setting, and we want to ask questions, but we somehow feel that the questions aren't welcomed or we're not asking them right. So rather than asking that question, we tend to shut down. But we must remember that when we shut down on a question we have, we may also shut down the answer that could be coming from someone else. Because it's like a collaborative and inclusive environment that depends upon questions and answers being actually happening right in front of you, you know, taking part in that. And so today, when I had an opportunity to talk with some of the leaders of CAPS, you know, I was able to really, you know, let's think about inquisitiveness. Let's think about to accelerate our imagination, because I wanted them to understand that the questions we ask will ignite our imagination, and it can take us to places that we've never been before. Sort of like Star Trek in 1966. We're going to go where no man or woman has ever gone before. And it's going to that place that we oftentimes discover not only who we are, but who we can become. Because the future sort of stares us in the face, and we're not afraid of it. We can run to it. We can make it happen. We can do what we need to do. And this is so important in a world that is being advanced by technology as rapidly as it is. Thomas Friedman recently said that our ability to adapt to change that is brought on by technology is much slower than the pace of the change. But we have a way out, you know, lifelong learning. Mm-hmm. And that is kind of what we talked about, putting ourselves in the position to not only learn, but to help others learn and to ask questions and to accelerate our imagination so that we can be more than we thought we could.
You had referenced, and I love this comparison to Star Trek, even though I'm not a Trekkie, so to speak, and I'm doing the symbols now. You can't see me on the on your radio, your iPad, iPod, whatever it is. iPod, man, how old am I? iPod, yikes. What I meant to say was your current technology device. But the reference to Star Trek, when you made the reference earlier, you talked about this image of a team of people working together collaboratively, but doing so in such a way that it was on the frontier, right? It was imagining what the future could be and putting our brain power together and coming together to kind of chart this new territory together.
You know, you said a word I have not used, but I'm going to use it from this point on.
Hope it wasn't iPod.
No. Brain power.
Okay.
And that is what we all have. But we live in a world that maturing is still happening. And I think that in 1966, Star Trek wanted to move us along that continuum a little faster. So they were showing us that the brain power needed rested in men and women. It rested in people with ears that were pointed. Hmm. It rested in people who looked like me by the ethnicity of my race. It rested in people that had scars on their face that you couldn't imagine. But yet, when they opened their mouth to talk, they had the right things to say. And I think that may have been the first time that we may have seen that on a consistent basis, that amalgamation of so many different types of people coming together to solve one problem.
That's an incredible take. I had never personally thought about that, but you're right. So many different visuals, viewpoints that were represented there. I'm curious, Clifton, as we think about inquisitiveness, let me be inquisitive around inquisitiveness with you, and that is, why do we often shut down an inquisitive mind? Because it does happen. We see it happen all the time, that someone has a question, or maybe they think they have a question, but they don't voice it. And there's something that we've done in our culture that has stymied that. And so what is your insight on that? Why are we stopping inquisitiveness from happening?
I don't think we have stopped it intentionally.
Okay.
It's just that back in our growing up, I think it where it starts. Questions, unless you're very careful, they don't really choose the time to be asked. And they can sometimes be asked at an inappropriate time.
Sure.
And people listening wish you would sort of be quiet and actually eat the food. And so rather than saying, let's take care of this later, they simply said, why don't you just quit and eat? And it is that feeling that you get when you're told that your question isn't valuable. Mm. Now, they don't say that.
But so it's the interpretation.
But the interpretation back to you is that I can't ask questions. And you may not say it that way, but you may try it one more time the next day at the dinner table or in the car with your mom or dad and ask several questions in rapid fire. And finally, your mother said, it would be so nice if you would be quiet. And so now you get in another hint that maybe asking too many questions is not a good thing to do. Hmm. So all along, you begin to slow down. You begin to cut it off because of the circumstances around that, the culture around that answer that you get. And then as an adult, you get a job, you go to work, you had a staff meeting, and all of a sudden I got to ask this question. Then you look around, ooh, I'm at work now, and I don't know all of these people here, and maybe they should think I should know this answer, and I shouldn't be asking this question. And before long, you talk yourself out of asking the question, because it's a very vulnerable position to be in, to ask questions.
Absolutely.
Because you're not quite sure how they will be taken and how you will be seen as a result of that. So over time, the questions are not asked, and answers are not provided.
That's great guidance and kind of a sad reality, I would say, that I mean, I'm sure people that are listening right now are having these same flashback moments that I'm having, where, especially when you have younger children, right? I've got a soon-to-be 10-year-old, yikes, I'm not ready for that, and a 7-year-old, both daughters, and very curious. They ask lots of questions, and I often enjoy interacting with them, but I would be completely lying to everyone if I said there weren't times that I had done exactly what you said, which is kind of try to shut it down or redirect, because it's not the right time, or, you know, supposedly the right time for them to ask those questions. I also think about other ways in which we might send those signals in a school environment or even just in our own lives. For example, cell phones. Mm-hmm. How often do we engage in conversations and the next thing you know, the person listening to you is, they're responding, but while they're doing it, they're staring at their phone. And what is that telling me about the interaction with this person, right?
So, yeah, it's probably telling you that what you have to say is not important as what they're doing. And, you know, and that's one of the side issues of technology that often bothers me. There's something nice about being able to look a person in the eye and talk to them, even if it's only for a couple of minutes.
Yeah,
an hour would be even better. But we tend to be busy. I'm not quite sure what we're busy doing, but we have allowed busyness to dictate our building of relationships. And I think we'll all be a little sorry for having done that because we're missing so much in doing that.
Well, I'm enjoying our time together. I'm looking you in the eyes right now. This is fantastic.
Yeah.
it's true. I mean, that building a community is so important. And, you know, when we think about coming back to education and the role of an instructor, the role of an administrator, those that are working with students, how can we continue to reinforce inquisitive mind, curiosity? Do you have some thoughts for those that are out there listening that are going into a classroom either later today or again tomorrow or next week of ways in which to build the community, to send the message and the signal to these students that what you have to say matters, that the questions you ask are really important because the future is in those questions many times.
Yeah.
So what are some ideas or thoughts of how you do that?
Well, first of all, I think it's important that the adults value the voice of a student. And I mean, really, truly value the voice. You know, you're not talking to an equal, that's understandable. But when it comes to the idea of our shared humanity, yes, we are talking to an equal. And we want to give them and leave them with the idea that what they have to say really matters. And so you want to put them in the position of having to answer as well as ask questions. And at the same time, it's always helpful is to have a notepad when it's adult and a young person and kind of take some notes on what they say. I have a feeling that pumps them up really good to see, wow. Let me tell you something. Mm-hmm. I remember when I spoke before the United States members of the Supreme Court, and Justice Ginsburg was sitting on the front row, and it was very exciting to see her. That later excitement turned to being petrified, maybe, because she had a notepad.
A little intimidating, maybe.
Yeah, she had a notepad and a pencil, and she was writing from what I was saying. But, you know, I was intimidated, but I felt so honored that my words would matter to the point that this very noteworthy lady would be taking notes on what I was saying. And I think, likewise, in an academic setting, that as adults, we need to find ways not to brush it off, but to welcome that question, to welcome that conversation with the young person, be it taking notes or simply standing there and asking another question and said, you know, I'd like to, and maybe end it by saying, oh, great exchange. I'd like to do this again sometime. Mm-hmm. Wouldn't you?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. It reminds me a little bit, and I'll certainly want to hear your reflections. You've been to CAPS a number of times here in Blue Valley. You've also been to some of our affiliate programs. You've been down to Little Rock, Arkansas, for example, where Mike Poor is a superintendent and doing some great work. You've been to St. Louis a number of times, specifically to see Lindenwood University, but as part of that, got to see some of our CAPS students
sure.
in action. And you've been here to Blue Valley, as I said, a number of times.
Arizona.
And you've been to Arizona.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. So
let's not forget hot Arizona.
You know, as it gets colder here, it seems to be a nicer place for us to go to see our friends at the, they call their program Peoria Met down in outside of Phoenix. But I say all that because I'm reminded of some of the conversations that happened this morning here as we were moving around the building. And just wondering, as we think about inquisitiveness, as we think about the future, as we think about empowering these young people, which is really important to our model, what are your reflections on what you've seen here as maybe compared to other places you've been, but also maybe challenging us a little bit on things that we need to continue to think about? Because we know that there's more that we can do with CAPS.
You know, there are several things that really struck me today. And one being how quickly students are ready to answer questions and how quickly they volunteer to tell their story. This is what I'm working on with great pride and not shying away. And if someone else is involved with them, they kind of walk back to that person as well and leave it that I didn't do this by myself. Mm. Now, this is not said, but it's implied in the body language. It's implied in the way they walk back to that other desk and put their hand on the back of the chair and say, yeah, this is what we did together. He came up with this and I came up with that. You know, just giving life to the word collaboration, giving life to the word inclusivity. But even so, there was one other thing. There were a group of students in a circle, and their teacher was with them, and they were discussing their capstone project. Yeah. But what I noticed that had nothing to do with what was said, but it had everything to do with the teacher and the students and their movement, that internal movement that I could sense in my spirit, I guess is for lack of a better term. It seemed as if the teacher stepped back so that the students could step up. And she was there to listen as we were, there to facilitate if need be. But more importantly, she was there to engage in that conversation and to get life-affirming words from those students as they would get life-affirming words from her. It was such a great example of teaching and learning in the 21st century.
Mm. So let me push a little bit here, because I'm always trying to think, and our team is trying to think of ways in which we can continue to evolve, knowing that, as you said earlier today, you know, that what we do today can be on the cutting edge, but 10 years from now, we're in a whole different world. And in fact, you made the reference that startled some of our staff, even, because we haven't, not all of us have thought about the ramifications, but this idea that in 10 years, we'll be teaching the millennials children.
Yeah.
And what is that going to look like?
Yeah.
Right? So what are some thoughts on how we remain mindful that we always need to stay on that cutting edge? What are some strategies for us? And is it embedded in this idea of asking questions? Is it pulling in other partners? I mean, what does it look like? If I'm sitting in a CAPS program that I'm directing, or I'm on an advisory board for CAPS, or I'm a teacher in a CAPS classroom, what are things I need to keep top of mind as I continue to move forward, so I'm ready in 10 years for that new generation of students?
I think the idea of embracing lifelong learning, but understanding that lifelong learning has a lot of numbers or alphabets under it, A, B, C, and D. It's reading more. It's visiting places that are future focused, so that you can always stay on track of that movement. It's the lifelong learning of understanding what I would call the nuances of technology and all that it brings into our lives, and realizing that every 6 months, something drastically new has come into our world, and that will continue. As I said earlier, what Thomas Friedman said is that technology is accelerating so fast that sometimes we feel we don't have enough time to adapt to it, but we can adapt to it through lifelong learning. And that learning can be a number of different things. It can be more interaction between, let's say, advisory board members and the network itself. Not just being supportive, but actually being a participant in the discovery of how tomorrow should look. Mm. And one of the other things, you know, in that advisory board, many of them represent companies that have to be future focused. And I think it would be great for educators to find themselves in their presence, listening up to them talk about how they are facing the future, what they're having to do in order to have their companies prepared for the next decade or the next couple of decades. It's just knowing that it's going to happen, and we have to be prepared for it. And it's not going to knock on the door at a certain time and ask our permission.
Sometimes we wish that it would,
of course,
right?
We
wish we'd get a memo at the beginning of the week that would tell us all we need to do to be prepared for the future.
Text or something.
A text, but, you know, and some kind of notification.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's tremendous. And kind of piggybacking off of that, some of the conversation that was spurred today in our discussions kind of got to that point of how do we rethink even some of the basic things where we've been successful. So for example, just to share with those that are out kind of across the country working in this program, Blue Valley CAPS being a program that's in year 11, we've had an advisory board pretty much that entire time, and it's been a highly successful sounding board for us. But one of our advisory board members was in a conversation with us, and he said, "I'm wondering if we don't go back to the very beginning and look at the questions we asked when we started the program and see if those questions are still relevant and how we would answer those." I mean, almost stripping everything back down, going to a blank canvas, and seeing where we go from there. So there seem to be a lot of different ways to go about imagining the future and living that. And you even gave an example of the founder of Ericsson.
Yeah.
Which would be kind of interesting to hear.
Yeah, Lars Ericsson in Sweden in the 1800s, mid-1800s. Poor kid, his dad died, so he had to step out of school into the world of work to help his mom and his siblings. And but he also had a natural inclination toward mechanical things. And about the time the telegraph came in, he just gravitated toward that. And even though he was working in the coal mines on the side, he was dreaming and imagining something else, his own business and being involved with the telegraph company. So he had a shop to fix the telegraphs. When they would break, they'd call him. And it grew, you know, because he literally put himself into that process and that project. And eventually, after Alexander Graham Bell brought the telephone into reality, he took a boat to America to learn all about that and taking it apart, taking notes and coming back to Sweden and creating that, which eventually became the forerunner to Ericsson we know today.
Yeah, and there's something in there. There are a couple of things that got teased out of that story for us. One was, don't be afraid to take things apart, right? Even if we've had a successful product or model or whatever, however you wanted to label CAPS or whatever the school program is that you work with, don't be afraid to take it apart to see what all the components are and how they play into it and what does it tell you. But also the idea that there may be others out there that if we take the time to explore, we kind of put ego aside and say, who else is out there? What are they doing? Even if they're in a different industry, that we could, by doing a deep dive on their organization, their efforts, their structure, we could learn quite a bit that could be valuable to us.
You know, and if you don't have that type of foresight to take things apart for the purpose of learning how much further can I go, what other things I can do, you'll end up in the proverbial box, comfortable with your success. You know, most people stay in the box, not simply because things aren't going well and that's where they are. They stay there because they're comfortable and they know that place. But I dare say that technology, as advancing as it is, has really disrupted that level of comfortability. You just won't have that anymore. So it's important to be looking for ways that I can stay outside of that box, which is the tried and the proven, looking for the next level of opportunity that I have.
I love that. You know, kind of going back to the thing that is core to us, or we call them the five core values of CAPS. You know, I think our listeners need to know one of our five core values here at CAPS is very much based on a philosophy that Clifton, you helped bring to the world, which is this idea of building entrepreneurial mindsets. And we believe it's really important for people to see entrepreneurship is more than just the process of starting a business, that there's a method of thinking, and much of what you just described with the story of Ericsson and this idea of how you get outside the box, that's important whether you're going to become a medical professional or an attorney or an engineer or a teacher. You know, the future is adaptive. It's going to have to be adaptive. And I guess I would just say thank you for the inspiration that you provided. You wrote a book about your Uncle Cleve that Who Owns the Ice House? It's become an international entrepreneurial mindset training program. So it's an important part of what we do. And that's really something that we value in terms of our students.
And again, you know, the book, Who Owns the Ice House, a collaborative effort between myself and the Eli Company out of Ohio, because I don't think either one of us would have accomplished that alone. Mm. It really took the both of us to make that happen.
Yeah.
And I think, again, which always goes to my conversation about relationships, how important relationships are, how important that buddy is next to you to help you solve a problem or for you to do likewise. You know, at the end of the day, relationships and our ability to respect, affirm, and include each other, those things will always be important.
Well, that's wonderful guidance there. And I will tell you, kind of along the same lines, every time I see our poster of our five core values in our atrium and I see entrepreneurial mindset, I picture you. And you deserve a lot of credit for us thinking that way. As we're kind of moving through our conversation here, one thing that I love to ask our guests on the show is if you could create your own moonshot. Like we've referenced Star Trek. We talked earlier today about the moon landing in 1969 and John F. Kennedy, you know, and along with others kind of saying, this is a place we're going to go. We're all going to come together. We're going to create this vision and we're going to make it happen. As we think about other things that we could do, and you've lived such an interesting and amazing life. You've had so many opportunities and you've brought a lot of joy to the world. But is there something that you are thinking about right now that if I could wave the magic wand and say, this is the world as I want it to be, this part of it, what would that be? What would you like to see happen? What's like a big experiment that you'd like to see be successful at this point?
You know, no one has ever asked me that question before, but it goes back to the inquisitive man and his questions, so thank you.
Well, totally themed for this episode, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love what education does to a young person. And I realize I wrote a book called The Invitation. And in that book, I said, this is to my son, Marshall, and to his generation. I said, we're passing the gauntlet to you to make this world a better place. Mm. That's your responsibility now. And I would love for the love of life and the love of learning and the love of people to be so around us, invading all of our space. And if I could have any part in making something like that happen, then I would think it would be a life lived well.
Mm. I love that. And The Invitation, Clifton referenced, a phenomenal book. It goes beyond leadership and business and all these things that we talk a lot about with what we do in our work, and gets right down to just the core of humanity, really, and love and acceptance and all of that with the context of the history that we've lived. And it's just an incredible book. I read it on a summer vacation a few years ago and fell in love with it. So any of you that are out there, certainly check out Clifton's books that he's written. He's written, what, 15 books 15. Now, published books. The Invitation should be right at the top of that list. Yeah. It's an incredible story. As we close out here today, I'm wondering if you would be open to sharing something that I heard for the first time yesterday, which is the story of your mom.
Sure.
And we talk so much about community and the people that get us where we are, and you have so many examples of that. I think we all do. But what an incredible story. So I would love for you just to have a few minutes to speak about your mom.
You know, my mom, Mary, my birth mom, she didn't raise me. I was raised by my great aunt, but I live right across the street from her. I should say right across the road from her. There weren't any streets in Glen Allen. So I live right across the road from my mom. But during the ending days of her life, my mother was an incredible educator in Head Start, changing lives all throughout Washington County, and is remembered for having done so. But prior to that, her life had been pretty challenged. She was a maid most of her life, and that's what we remember those mornings, that a car would come and pick her up and we wouldn't see her again till the end of the day. But she was a firm believer in education. And at some point there were friends, Jake Ayers and Ann Britton, who convinced my mother to go back to college, because she had gone to college for a year. Probably, I don't know, in the 30s or something. I'm not quite sure when. But she's been out of school now 30 or 40 years, so, you know, a long time. And people are not thinking about going back to college at that age. You know, how do I just get through my life? But she did. In order to become involved in Head Start, she had to go to school back at the University of Alabama in Tuscaloosa. And she literally had to hitchhike her way there and to borrow clothes from another friend of hers. But she got there and learned upon her matriculation through the university and through the programs they had in place that she was an A student. And she eventually became the director of the Yates Center in Washington County that Robert Kennedy, Rose Kennedy, and Sergeant Shriver came to the Mississippi Delta to see this lady that everybody called Miss Mary.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Wow.
It was just, it's an incredible story of the possibilities of what can happen when people realize the value of their presence on the life of another person.
Wow. And if I understood correctly yesterday, her work while she was in school is now archived somewhere.
Yeah,
is that correct?
Yeah, that's what I was right outside of New York City doing a lecture, and the chancellor, who was getting her doctorate or had gotten a doctorate from New York University, said that in the field of social work, said that they had to read my mother's work. Said, I'm thinking, I couldn't figure out how he could have gotten there, but I realized that the Office of Economic Opportunity, which the Head Start came under at that time, was a federal organization. And perhaps all of the papers from that went to that university. Hmm. And my mother's papers were among those chosen for students to read.
What an unbelievable story. And from an unbelievable person with his own unbelievable story, Clifton, can't thank you enough for being such a friend and champion of our program. And I think I speak for everyone that you've been around on this particular trip to CAPS, how thankful we are that you spend your time with us. Time is a precious commodity.
And yeah, but it's a pleasure. I always get reinvigorated when I come here. The students do it. The faculty does it as well. It's just amazing to me to come here and watch tomorrow unfold in front of me.
Wonderful. Well, we appreciate you very much. And for those of you out there that want to learn more about Clifton, he has his own website. There are lots of, I know from being out on YouTube, for example, lots of clips of him speaking. Incredible storyteller. And books available widely. I know that you can get them on Amazon and some other places as well. So make sure you look into our friend Clifton and all that he has to share with us. And with that, my friends, we've reached the end of another podcast episode. Please keep working hard. We know that we are getting closer and closer to a tipping point in education. And you are all on the front lines. You are making it happen. And it's this community that is going to continue to propel us into the future. We're so thankful for you, and we will catch you next time.